Hello, this is Tony Reid. Welcome to Capity Gay, a programme for LGBTI people and their friends on Coast Access Radio 104.7 FM and other access radio stations around New Zealand. Today I was going to do a review of a new book, but I really got bogged down in it, and then when I read some reviews I realised why I wasn't doing very well with it. So I thought, what shall I do instead? And I'm instead reviewing a book I've had for over 40 years. It's called Prick Up Your Ears. Yes, that was meant to be a pun. And it's a famous biography of the gay British playwright called Joe Orton. And I've certainly had in the back of my mind about doing a programme about him for ages. So, welcome to the world of Joe Orton. Prick Up Your Ears became available in paperback in 1980, which I noticed the year that I got my copy. It's by a biographer called John Lahr, who was, well, still is, because he's still alive in his 80s, the son of Bert Lahr, the famous Cowardly Lion from The Wizard of Oz. And he opens up with the famous ending of Joe Orton's life. Joe Orton and Kenneth Halliwell were friends. For 15 years they lived and often wrote together. They wore each other's clothes. Their wills named each other as sole beneficiary. They shared everything except success. But on 9th of August 1967, murder made them equal again. Joe was born on the 1st of January 1933. He was the oldest child, was followed by Douglas, Marilyn and Leonie. Leonie, who was 11 years younger than him, was always the one he was closest to. He was born in Leicester, which is described as unimaginative mediocrity in the book. A rather long-standing reputation of that city, only recently modified somewhat by the discovery of a king buried under a car park in it. He had a very meek father. He had a mother who hated sex. She commented she never knew how she managed to have four children. And that affected his attitude and some of his best lines in his plays. For example, in What the Butler Saw, "You were born with your legs apart. They'll send you to the grave in a Y-shaped coffin." Always a favourite, that one. The audience roars normally. Sex was always important to Joe, and especially casual sex. He always wanted to be an actor, though he wasn't very good. He took he took elocution lessons to get rid of his Leicester accent, and applied to RADA, the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art in London, in 1950. He describes his audition, which was typically rather bizarre. "I did a piece from Peter Pan between Captain Hook and Smee, both at the same time, a kind of schizophrenic act. The Hook-Smee exchange contained the frenzy that always fired his imagination. It was quite alarming," Orton recalled. "It impressed the judges." So in 1951, he got into RADA. And in May 1951, he left Leicester forever. He then met Kenneth Halliwell, who was also studying at RADA. Halliwell had come into some money and was rather more able to afford somewhere decent to live than the other students. So the group that Joe Orton shared a flat with left their horrid flat and moved in. And at that point, he was keeping a RADA diary, which actually stops with this entry. Very brief entry for each day. 8th June, met Ken. He invites us to live with him. 9th June, went to the pictures. 10th June, did nothing. 11th June, must leave our digs. 12th June, Ken offers to share flat again. I say no. Ken offers again. We accept because we must. 16th of June, move into Ken's flat. 17th of June, well. 18th of June, well, 2 exclamation marks. 19th of June, well, 3 exclamation marks. The rest is silence. The two were not successful actors, and they basically disappear from view after they leave RADA for 11 years. They lived together, but didn't really do very much. Quote again, "The greatest impression Orton and Halliwell made at RADA was on each other. Neither had previously been able to sustain a close relationship. Both were disgruntled and lonely. Each filled an absence in the other's life. Halliwell finds in Orton a surrogate brother, a companion who looked up to him, who needed him, who had faith in his intelligence and his aspirations. Orton was good company, a buoyant, inquisitive chatterbox, who was also a good listener. In Halliwell, Orton discovered someone who could be both father and friend, an authoritarian figure older and wiser in the ways of the world, who shared his interests and was prepared to engage in an unequal but enthusiastic dialogue. Each answered a crucial need in each other. But then in 1962, they got into the news, for the first time, over the library book. The English public first learned of Orton and Halliwell 11 years later in 1962. It was not exactly the debut they dreamed of. On 15th of May, the Daily Mirror devoted a banner headline to a story about a mischievous form of literary vandalism. Books from the Islington and Hampstead libraries were appearing on the shelves with photographs and book jackets humorously altered. The Mirror story was headed Gorilla in the Roses, which referred to a monkey's head pasted in the middle of a rose on the cover of the Collins Guide to Roses. In Leicester, the Orton family had skimmed the Mirror, and all except William had gone to bed. He settled in front of the television. During the commercials, William picked up the papers again. He perused Gorilla in the Roses, expected to find some gardening tips. When he read the small print, he rushed upstairs to tell Elsie, his wife. "Our John's been nicked," he announced. Elsie wouldn't believe it. She phoned the paper to confirm the story. Anyway, they were found out by quite a clever detective ruse, actually, from somebody in the library. They actually went to prison for defacing these library books in the rather humorous comments they added. One should add now that these library books are now a prime display in Islington libraries, you know, behind glass, sacred to look at. But probably because they were recognised as being a gay couple, even though they weren't prosecuted as such, they were sent to prison. Prison was more of a turning point in their life than either Orton or Halliwell at first admitted. Orton found a focus for his anger and a new detachment in his writing. For Halliwell, prison was more humiliating, a symbol of a larger pattern of defeat in his life. It made a mockery of his dreams for himself, dreams which Orton had adopted in 1953. So, in the case of Orton, his professional breakthrough came the next year, quite quickly, with BBC Radio 3 broadcasting a play which at that stage was called Ruffian on the Stair. But at that point, he had already nearly finished writing Entertaining Mr. Sloane, which was the first of his three full-length plays, which are now his main legacy. The second half of Lars' biography consists mostly of a detailed analysis of those plays, which I will not attempt here. All are farces, but not standard farces. If you just have the comedy, you miss the point, as American productions unfortunately often have done, and you miss the subtext, which proves so essential. But if you only keep the subtext, then the play is no longer a farce. All three of the plays depend on getting the balance right, and unfortunately many productions do not. I first saw Entertaining Mr. Sloane on the stage in such a production, and it was awful. I had high hopes of a Wellington production at Downstage a few years later, but was also disappointed. It can be rather wordy, and pace is very important. However, again to quote Mr. Lahr, Entertaining Mr. Sloane caught the abrasive and expansive mood of the time. From what I remember, they, his family, was respected, Sloane tells Kath. You know, HP, debts, bridge, a little light gardening. So it very much caught the mood of the 1960s. He had to make lots of changes, especially in the ending. Most of his plays went through lots of rewrites. The current version was captured by the most successful of the movies based on made from his plays. Doubtless the casting of Beryl Reid as Kath helped there, and she repeated the role in the classic 1975 Festival of the Plays, which established them all as classics. The most successful contemporary British playwright, Terence Rattigan, became a big fan, however, as a result of seeing Entertaining Mr. Sloane, and wrote to Joe, in May 1964. Dear Joe Orton, I don't think you've written a masterpiece, and you wouldn't want me to say that you had, but I do think you have written the most exciting and stimulating first play that I have seen in 30-odd years playgoing. I think you will write a masterpiece before the decade is out, provided always that you don't try to, but your gift of dialogue is such that whatever you write will henceforth provide pleasure, and not only to me, but to many hundreds of thousands of others. So, in a sense, that wasn't terribly helpful, because Terence Rattigan and Joe Orton were so different, the plays are just so different, that it could have encouraged Joe to go off on a tangent and write like Rattigan, but he didn't. New York produced almost a success with Sheila Hancock as Kath, but the critics successfully killed it off, especially the New York Times, as actually still happens quite a bit. The second play is Loot, where two young men raid a bank and hide the money in the coffin in their house, the coffin that was supposedly contained their mother. Initially, the play was a disaster due to the casting of comedian Kenneth Williams as Police Inspector Truscott. The balance between farce and social commentary was truly broken. Williams and Orton did become close friends, however, but nothing else positive came out of this casting. The play did shock because of its farcical treatment of death. Dead bodies and glass eyes were central. I did see a production of this in Leeds, which was generally very good, the inspector showing the right balance between being sinister and being farcical. But already most of the shock value was beginning to wear off then, and possibly has even more. Still, in its revised form in Manchester and then London, Loot fared much better. Well, Kenneth Williams wasn't in it for a start. In particular, when it won the Evening Standard Drama Award for the Best Play of 1966, it became the hit of the season and Orton became famous. His final play is What the Butler Saw. This parodies the whole nature of farce and is generally thought of as his masterpiece. It takes place in a psychiatrist's clinic. As well as dealing with madness, there is a flexible, if not confusing, attitude towards gender, which gives the play considerable continuing relevance nowadays. This is my favourite play, but then I was in it. Our adventurous local drama group produced it, and I played Dr. Rance, the visiting psychiatrist who takes charge of the chaos. A sample of the dialogue, with my favourite line in it, I seem to recall at the beginning of Act Two, and the young girl who was visiting to become a secretary, and the page boy, for some reason, and I can't remember why, change into each other's clothes, so there is confusion as to which is the boy and which is the girl. And Rant says to Geraldine, "Do you think yourself as a girl?" And Geraldine says, "No. Why not? I'm a boy. Do you have the evidence about you?" "I must be a boy. I like girls." Rance aside to the other doctor, Dr. Prentice, "I can't quite follow the reasoning there." When I said that line, I was well known in the local drama group. It got a very big laugh, I remember. And Prentice replies, "Many men imagine that a preference for women is ipso facto a proof of virility." Rance, nodding sagely, "Someone should really write a book on these folk myths. Take your trousers down. I'll tell you which sex you belong to." "Geraldine, I'd rather not know." "You wish to remain in ignorance?" "Yes. I can't encourage you in such a self-indulgent attitude. You must face fact like the rest of us." The part I played, Dr. Rance, was originally played in the West End by a dreadfully miscast Sir Ralph Richardson, who didn't really know what he was talking about. The American production was even worse. It just played as a silly farce. It was very popular, but very wrong. Ken Halliwell, despite Joe's fame and his lack of fame, was still around and advising aspect of the script. Orton had started keeping a diary again when he became successful. The diaries have all been published, edited by John Lahr, of course. So in this later bit, he can quote from the diaries considerably. He says, "Kenneth read the script of What the Butler Saw and was enthusiastic. He made several important suggestions, which I'm carrying out. He was impressed by the way in which, using the context of a farce, I had managed to produce a golden bough subtext. Even he pointed out the castration of Sir Winston Churchill, the father figure, and the descent of the god at the end, Sergeant Match, the policeman, drugged and dressed in a woman's gown. It was only to be expected that Kenneth would get these references to classical literature. Whether anyone else will spot them is another matter. You must get a director who, while making it funny, brings out the subtext, Ken said. So Ken had hit the nail on the head there, but only in the 1975 Festival of Plays, which I've already referred to, was this fully recognised. Possibly Butler struggled more becoming recognised and successful because Joe was not around to do the rewrites. He enjoyed rewrite, and of course he only just had finished the document before he was killed. Intriguing, but it was intriguing that Ken was still able to advise Joe and that Joe still listened. When they were both failures in their small Islington flat, Ken was the senior one, Joe the junior. Joe's success, and with it a new confidence, changed everything, and Ken just couldn't cope. He became more and more insecure, and Joe's friends advised Joe to leave him. Joe said he never would, but was frequently annoyed with him and seemed to threaten an end to their relationship. As for Ken, he could never forgive Orton his happiness. He became more and more fearful. He also read Orton's very explicit diary, which didn't help at all. Shortly after the complete manuscript of What the Butler Saw was sent to Joe's agent, Peggy Ramsey, Halliwell completely cracked, and on the night of 8th to 9th of August 1967, he got a hammer and smashed the head of the sleeping Orton. He then wrote a suicide note and took an overdose. The gruesome scene was discovered the next morning when a chauffeur arrived to take Joe to a meeting. Almost immediately, Orton's death became more famous than his work. Many interpreted his death as retribution for the unrelenting anarchy of his laughter. But Orton was not hounded by society into a self-conscious martyrdom. He was not a victim of the gospel of ecstasy, which burnt out the lives of so many pop stars of the 60s. A voluptuary of fiasco, Orton died from his short-sighted and indecisive loyalty to a friend. They had left everything to each other, but Ken did apparently die before Joe, so Orton's relatives inherited. Leone's husband clearly disapproved of the plays, especially ensuring their young children knew very little about their wicked uncle. Leone reminded him that without Joe, they would not have been able to afford their nice new living room curtain. Really close with a little bit about the film. The film is much more famous than the book. It was made in 1987, the same year the diaries were published, and was very successful. It comes up when you Google Prick Up Your Ears. It had a series of brilliant actors, Gary Oldman as Orton and Alfred Molina as Halliwell. Vanessa Redgrave played the agent Peggy Ramsey. Julie Walters played Joe Orton's mum. And the screenplay was by Alan Bennett. He was very good at writing Orton-esque lines. For example, at the very end, Halliwell was cremated one day and then Orton the next. A suggestion was made that the ashes be mixed, together, and they asked Douglas, the oldest surviving brother of Joe. Well, he said, agreeing, as long as nobody hears about it in Leicester. And there's a lovely scene which is created, which is pure Alan Bennett, but Alan Bennett writing something that Joe Orton would have written. So Leone is mixing the ashes. I think I'm putting in more of Joe than I am of Kenneth. Peggy, it's a gesture, dear, not a recipe. Which is rather nice. The ashes were mixed and scattered in the Golders Green Garden of Remembrance. Their deaths confirm the vision of Orton's comedy. Reality is the ultimate outrage. Their epitaph was Orton's plays, a heritage of laughter created out of a lifetime's hunger for revenge. So, that's a book review I've been sitting on for 40 years. I have got time for a little bit of music now. I wasn't sure I would. And this is very much a personal thing. I've lived with two friends for many years, Steve, who started this programme, and Kevin. And they've, and since Kevin retired last year, they've been going on lots of cruises together, and they were in the Mediterranean a few weeks ago, and Steve came back to the cabin to find Kevin dead on the bathroom floor. It's obviously a huge shock. He was very much the linchpin of our household, and I realise I've been living with him with only short gaps for over 40 years. So, some big changes coming up. We're both fans of the musical South Pacific, and we both agreed that Emil Lübeck's second song, This Nearly Was Mine, was much better than the more famous Some Enchanted Evening. So I shall play This Nearly Was Mine in memory of Kevin. This is from the famous Broadway revival of about 15 years ago, where Emil Lübeck was sung by gay opera singer Paolo Schott, who is still around on Broadway, as you'll probably hear in the next programme. But in the meanwhile, here is Paolo Schott singing This Nearly Was Mine from South Pacific.
still dreaming of paradise, still saying that paradise once nearly was a
You can hear this programme again next Tuesday at 8 p.m. or Thursday at 5 p.m. It is also available on our website at www.coastaccessradio.org.nz or just Google Coast Access Radio, Kapiti Gay. This is Tony Reid for GAY on Coast Access Radio 104.7 FM and other access radio stations around New Zealand.
This program was made with assistance from New Zealand On Air for radio broadcast and through the accessmedia.nz website. Thank you, New Zealand On Air.